This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. As we've mentioned, birds and bird behavior are our topic this afternoon. Our guest, David Allen Sibley. He's an illustrator. Last year, his guide, The Sibley Guide to Birds, was published. He wrote and illustrated that guide. Now just published, The Sibley Guide to Bird Life and Behavior. Mr. Sibley is the illustrator. The essays on bird life and behavior written by leading ornithologists. Both books are publications of the National Audubon Society, published by the Society, for the Society, I guess I should say, here by Knopf. David Allen Sibley is the son of the well-known ornithologist Fred Sibley. David Sibley began studying birds and drawing birds in 1969 when he was 7 years old. Since then, he's written and illustrated many articles on bird identification. You'll find him on the World Wide Web at www.sibleyart, that's SibleyArt.com. Listeners, I invite your questions about birds this afternoon. Join the conversation with a telephone call. Here are the telephone numbers, and these are the numbers to join us here on the Afternoon Magazine. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Mr. Sibley, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
How many people were involved in making this book possible?
Oh, lots and lots.
Yeah.
I think the total number of authors is 48 different authors contributed parts of the book, different chapters or parts of chapters. And then there were two technical editors who reviewed everything for accuracy and consistency, and one managing editor who managed to keep everybody on schedule and under control, and then a team of copy editors and designers and other behind-the-scenes folks at the publisher.
Yeah. But I'm imagining here what it was like to try to decide what to include and how to organize this project.
Yeah, that to me is one of the most interesting and challenging parts of any book, is deciding exactly what's going to go in it, and this one was no different. It took a couple of years, really, to sort out what we wanted to include, and the idea was to include information that that hadn't been included in my first book, which came out last year, which was strictly about how to identify birds. It didn't give details about what they do or why what sorts of habitats they're found in, unless that was useful for identification. So we had that idea to begin with, that it was to be a companion book, but that still leaves a wide range of options.
Yeah. There's so much information here. I mean, there's, you know, how and why birds fly. There's information on feeding, mating, nesting, migration, feather structure. There's so much here.
Yeah, some of that information is available in ornithology textbooks,
mm-hmm.
Which aren't really something that the average birdwatcher is going to pick up and read. And a lot of the detailed information is in a couple of books that were already in print that have listings of data for each species. So you can look up a particular species and see what type of nest it builds, how many eggs it lays, whether it is monogamous or polygamous or territorial or colonial, that sort of information. And what we decided to do was to take all that data and summarize it for the reader, to instead of giving details of little bits of data for each species, to write a chapter about each family of related species and then summarize the information so that we could give an overview of the family and the general patterns of all these different aspects, and also get into some of the questions like how birds fly, why they migrate, and more general questions about each family, like how a woodpecker actually climbs a tree, what's going on when it's hitching itself up the side of a tree, how hummingbirds get nectar out of a flower, the relationship between different species of hummingbirds and different species of flowers. All that sort of stuff could be presented in a book like this with an essay about each family, and is not so easily done when you're just giving data for each species.
Mm. I mentioned in the introduction that you've been drawing birds now for some time, since you were a little boy, 7 years old. Do you recall the first bird that you drew?
No, I don't. It was actually even before I was 7 years old. I think I was probably five or even four when I first started tracing pictures of birds out of some of the books that were around our house. With my father being an ornithologist,
right,
there were bird books around the house. And from as long ago as I can remember, I was tracing pictures out of those books.
What was it that first intrigued you about birds? Was it flight?
No, it was... I can't even say. I was intrigued by birds even before I really was watching them in the wild. I was intrigued by them, by the pictures in these books. I liked looking at the pictures. I liked the action. So maybe it did have to do with flight, the fact that in some of these paintings, and some of my favorite ones, the birds are flying, and those are the ones that I traced over and over.
Yeah. When you set out to do an illustration of a bird or birds, how do you think about it? How do you approach the task?
Well, it has to start with a familiarity with the birds. So most of what I've done is traveled around the country and tried to see all of these different species of birds and to study them and sketch them in the field. So once I've done that, and I have a set of sketches, and I have a file at home where I've collected all kinds of reference materials, photographs and reprints of scientific papers and anything else that I could use as reference material for each species. So when I sit down to do a painting back in my studio, I'll pull out the file for each species and look over my sketches and photographs and other people's paintings and written descriptions and try to put all that together to do a painting.
Hmm. Where did your family live when you were a boy? Where did you grow up?
We moved around a little bit when I was young. When I was 5 to 7, when I started showing an interest in birds, we lived in Southern California, in a town called Ojai, and my father was studying California condors. That was late 1960s, there were still about 60 California condors in the wild. And then after that, we moved to Point Reyes, California for a year and a half, and then back to Connecticut in 1970. So most of my youth and most of my birdwatching, my early bird watching was in Connecticut.
Mm. And what kinds of birds are in your backyard at this point in the year there in Connecticut?
Well, I'm living in Massachusetts right now.
Oh, sorry about that.
It's close enough. It's pretty much the same as Connecticut. So, well, we have a bunch of bird feeders in the backyard, of course, and right now a lot of mourning doves and goldfinches. The first dark-eyed juncos have just come back for the winter, and we'll have a big flock of those all winter. But it's always exciting. I think that's one of the things that makes birdwatching so popular, is that you can put up bird feeders, and then every time you look out your window, you have a chance of seeing something different. You can actually do birdwatching from inside your house, and the birds outside your windows are constantly changing.
Hmm. I was stepping outside this morning, and it was rather brisk and bracing. In fact, it still is brisk and bracing here today. We're in the mid-40s with the wind up in the range of 20-plus miles per hour. And the robins are still out there here. And I'm wondering, Boy, how long will it be before they fly away?
Yeah, well, I don't know what it's like out there in Illinois, but here in New England, quite a few robins are now spending the whole winter.
Really?
Which they never used to do. 20 years ago, they wouldn't spend the winter here. But the theory, the explanation that people give is that so many berry-producing trees and shrubs have been planted in the suburbs around people's houses and neighborhoods that now there are enough berries, enough food for robins to survive the winter here. So they spend the winter in pretty big numbers. And the robin, at least in New England, is no longer just a harbinger of spring. They're here all winter.
That's interesting. I'm going to ask our listeners to, if someone is out there who, I guess I'm kind of a casual bird watcher, you know, just out the window in the yard, but I haven't noticed any robins in the winter here. Mm-hmm. But maybe somebody out there who's a better birder than I could join us and tell us what they've observed. Listeners, your questions about birds are welcome. Also, if you can tell us what's up with robins in our neck of the woods, that would be terrific. Here are the telephone numbers to join the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon is David Allen Sibley. He's an illustrator. Last year, his guide, The Sibley Guide to Birds, was published. This year, just published The Sibley Guide to Bird Life and Behavior. And we've got a listener ready to talk with us on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
We do have a few robins that stay over. Most of them are males. They tend to congregate around bushes with berries, and I've seen quite a number of them out in the Illini plantations out on South Ray Street,
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of conifers and a lot of wind cover. There's not lots of them, but I do see them and I do hear them.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, I want to thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Are other bird populations changing their migratory behavior?
Yeah, they're constantly changing. The birds are pretty opportunistic, so if a new food source becomes available and they don't have to migrate as far as they used to, they'll change their patterns. And they'll change their patterns with the changes in weather patterns, changing climate. There's been a gradual shift of quite a few species from expanding their range from south to north over the last 100 years. And again, here in New England, where I know a lot about the bird distribution, there are birds like cardinal and blue-winged warbler, northern mockingbird, tufted titmouse, red-bellied woodpecker. Those are southern species that 50 years ago weren't found in Massachusetts or were very rare visitors and are now common and widespread across the entire state and still increasing. And there are, I know in the Great Lakes area, with the recent outbreak of zebra mussels around the Great Lakes, there's been a huge change in the wintering patterns of some of the diving ducks that feed on mussels and clams. Ducks like scaup and scoters that will eat zebra mussels are now wintering in huge numbers at the western end of Lake Ontario. And that's the area that I've heard of. There may be similar things happening around Lake Erie. And it's all due to zebra mussels, that the birds they're on their way from Canada, the nesting grounds, down to the Atlantic. They used to winter a lot around Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. And now they get halfway and stop on the Great Lakes to take a rest and find so much food that they can spend the whole winter there.
Hmm, that's interesting.
That's a change that's happened just within a few years.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one. Hello.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Hello. A couple of things. My cousin, I live here in Champaign. I understand you live up in New England. Last spring, my cousin Lewis saw a bald eagle up at the Middle Fork Wildlife Preserve north of Penfield here in central Illinois, but that's not really what I want to hear you talk about. My cousin Lewis, again here in Champaign, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, he religiously feeds birds and squirrels, and he had a doggone bluebird show up at his house. And what I'd like to, if our caller could tell us, this is central Illinois, and we used to have tons of bluebirds in this area, and if he could tell us why we don't have so many anymore and how we might get them back. And I appreciate you all being there. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Well, bluebirds, bald eagle is a species that has increased a lot over the last 20 years or so. And there's even talk of removing it from the endangered species list. They're doing so well. So they're increasing a lot, people should expect to see more of them. They're still not common, but there are a lot more than there were 20 years ago. Now, bluebirds here in New England have increased a lot in the last 20 years. It's a species that likes open space like pasture land or orchards, open space with some trees. And one of the things that caused the population to decline in the mid-1900s was competition with starlings for nest sites. That the starlings, which are introduced from Europe, nest in holes in trees or in birdhouses and are much more aggressive than the bluebirds. So they were so successful and so aggressive that they were crowding out all the bluebirds from the nesting sites. And the bluebirds have started to recover once people started putting out nest boxes designed specifically for bluebirds with a hole that's a little bit too small to allow a starling to enter. So with these boxes that the starlings can't use and the bluebirds can, and a lot of effort from some very dedicated people who have formed the Bluebird Society in many different states. The bluebirds have come back very strongly. So the lack of bluebirds in a particular area there might be due to development. It might be due to land use changes like that. Or it might be due to competition for nest sites.
Hmm.
And if it's just the nest sites, then putting out some of these bluebird houses might bring them back.
Yeah. In your book, you cite several sources for folks interested in conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a source that you would recommend for getting started?
There are a number of the conservation organizations, and any one of them is a good place to start. The National Audubon Society, of course, has
mm-hmm.
chapters all over the country, so there's probably a local chapter of the National Audubon Society in your area there, and getting involved at the local level is can be really good. It brings the whole issue close to home, and then you can actually feel like you're doing something and getting involved with local people. The Nature Conservancy is focused on preserving habitat, buying land, and a huge amount, something like 85% of all the money that goes to the Nature Conservancy, all the donations, goes right back into their programs to buy land. And since habitat loss is, I think, by far the biggest threat facing birds today, that I think the Nature Conservancy is doing a great job, and is just a great organization.
Mm. You know, I live in a forested urban area, lots of trees, established landscape, and the neighborhood has been home this summer to a red-shouldered hawk. And I've got to be thinking that that's got to be, well, it's my theory anyway, that that's due to habitat loss. What do you think?
Oh, you mean it's been it's been forced out of
yeah,
somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be hanging out there if it didn't find the habitat suitable in some way. So it may be a reflection more of the fact that there is something that it actually likes in that habitat.
Mm.
And if your neighborhood is wooded enough, and if there are some patches of woods with undergrowth that are relatively undisturbed, where the hawk could actually build a nest without having people walking underneath it all the time, it might really find a home there.
Hmm. Interesting. The other birds in the neighborhood are not pleased.
No.
But it's a magnificent bird.
Yeah.
Beautiful bird. What do birds, do they, what they eat, their diet, does it vary season to season?
It does. It depends a lot on the species, of course. Every species has particular preferences. And most species have different preferences or make different choices at different times of the year, so that the sparrows that we see at the bird feeders all winter eating seeds eat 90% insects and caterpillars and things like that in the summer. And that's most of what they feed to their young is animal food like insects, which has a lot of protein and helps the young birds grow. And there are quite a few studies of the food that birds feed to their nestlings changing over time as the nestlings grow. And one interesting study in California that I remember reading about some gulls, and gulls have a reputation for eating just anything. They hang around at garbage dumps. They hang around fast food restaurants. So they'll eat anything that you throw to them. But someone studied these gulls in California and found that the adults were visiting the dumps and shopping mall parking lots to find food for themselves. But the food that they were actually bringing back and giving to their nestlings, their growing babies, was fish, actual natural food that they went out into the ocean and caught. So they were making a choice to provide real quality food for their young for a few weeks while they were growing. But when they weren't catching food to feed to their young, they headed off to the garbage dump to get some old chicken bones or half-eaten hamburgers or whatever else they could find.
No fries for the wee ones.
No.
That's interesting. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you about today was the intelligence of birds. How intelligent are they? How do they compare intelligence-wise with other critters?
I think there have been a lot of studies on that, and mostly the results have been that birds are more intelligent than they appear at first glance. They're more intelligent than they've been given credit for. But I would also make the point that when we're talking about birds, it's an entire class of animals. It's like talking about mammals. And you can't really compare the intelligence of dogs with the intelligence of bats any more than you can compare the intelligence of a pigeon with the intelligence of a loon, say. I'm sure there's a whole range of variation of intelligence across different species of birds, but some, like parrots and ravens and even pigeons, have proven to be really intelligent in experiments, able to solve some problems and to learn the solution to problems so that they can figure it out more quickly the second time. They are quite intelligent. Some of the stuff that, like the gulls choosing the food that they feed to their young, is instinctive. There's some instinctive element to that. It may not be intelligence as much as some sort of hormonal urge that drives them to feed their young in a certain way. And it's always hard to distinguish those things.
Yeah. You mentioned parrots as intelligent birds. I spoke not too long ago with an ornithologist at Rutgers, Joanna Berger. Do you know her work?
Yeah.
She's written a lovely book about her parrot, Tico.
Oh, yeah.
And Tico, she told us, goes to a jar that sits on a shelf that contains feathers, and he'll take one out of the jar, and with the sharp end, the nib, is that what you call the sharp end of the feather? He scratches himself. Very intelligent little guy.
Yeah, they're, I think birds, they're not as dexterous as we are. They don't have fingers to hold things. They don't have a lot of opportunities to show their intelligence. But with things like that, it's obvious that they have some problem-solving abilities.
This is something I learned from the Guide to Bird Life and Behavior, David, that birds essentially spend their lives standing on tiptoe. Speaking of Tico and his using his toes, what we call a bird's foot is really just the toes.
Yeah. Yeah, if you think about the way a chicken's leg bends, the bare bony part of the chicken's leg that we're seeing is it corresponds to our foot, and if you think about the way it bends, that's the way our leg bends, and the upper leg is entirely hidden underneath the bird's feathers.
So they really do very well keeping their balance while they're on the ground, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things that I learned, actually, in reviewing and editing all the work for the Guide to Bird Life and Behavior, is just the simple concept that birds have had to make so many modifications to their, or they've evolved so many modifications to their body proportions and their lifestyle as a result of using their forelimbs for wings. That once they turn their arms into wings that are good for flying but nothing else, everything else about their body has to be adapted to be lightweight and very functional. So they have all their muscles and all their weight concentrated in a small and low center of gravity. And then their legs and feet have to be strong but lightweight, and they have to be able to balance on their two legs. And then their bill has to be lightweight but able to perform all the things that that they would have done with their forelegs and hands.
Mm-hmm. But then you have the penguins and the puffins. And the puffin still flies, but not real well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and they've just made other trade-offs that both of them penguins and puffins, they're unrelated. They're not very closely related to each other, but they've adapted to similar lifestyles, and they use their wings for propulsion underwater, which has it works very well for them underwater, but the same type of wing that can propel a bird underwater doesn't work so well in the air. So the puffins have made big trade-offs and don't fly very well, and the penguins have made even bigger trade-offs and given up flying altogether, flying in the air, rather.
Yeah. The birds who live at sea, especially the ones that spend long hours out there, how do they make a living?
They know where to find food. They all catch fish or plankton or other types of food out of the surface of the ocean. And they'll concentrate in big numbers in places where food is concentrated, at the edges of currents or areas of upwelling.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a very difficult way to make a living, but I suppose one of the important concepts to think about there is that the ocean is not just a uniform, trackless surface, that it has habitats within it, so that certain species of birds are found in certain ocean conditions where the water temperature and salinity and amount of sunlight and upwelling and all the rest of that is at certain levels. So you can predict where, even very specifically, where in the ocean you'll find certain species of birds, and even look at satellite photos of ocean surface temperature and make some pretty good predictions about what birds you'll find at each particular location.
Let's talk with another listener, this one on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
My grandson helps me with the spring bird count every in May, and he recently went off to Drake University in Des Moines, and he was home on break and said he had seen a different hawk. And I gave him a book on hawks, and I have another flyer of hawks on the in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, 5 hours from Chicago in Des Moines, what kind of different birding would he see? Would he find different hawks there?
No, it wouldn't be much different from the birds that you would see in Illinois. There are a few western species of hawks that might reach there a little more frequently than they do in Illinois, but they would still be quite rare. So I think the list of species that he would need to consider would be essentially the same as the ones in Illinois.
That's what I kind of thought. Is there any one special bird? Would he see the black-headed black-headed, yellow-headed blackbird that's rare east of the Mississippi River? Would he see that more frequently there?
Yeah, there may be some birds like that, or western meadowlark.
The western meadowlark.
Some other western species that might reach Iowa in some numbers. And,
would he see any different hummingbirds?
No.
No?
No. Still just the ruby-throated.
Oh, gosh.
Except on very rare occasions when another species might wander in.
I wonder how far west you have to go to see a different species of hummingbirds. Okay, thank you much. It's interesting listening to your program. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, David Allen Sibley, author of The Sibley Guide to Birds and The Sibley Guide to Bird Life and Behavior, for which he did the illustrations and also shared in the editing tasks as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. What has been the most curious bird behavior you've witnessed?
I was in Texas about 10 years ago watching a group of black vultures and a couple of crested caracaras, which is an a caracara is actually in the falcon family, but it's a scavenger. It eats carrion just like vultures do. So these black vultures and caracaras were hanging around in an open field where there was some carrion, some dead animals available that they were feeding on, but they were just resting around the edges of the field. And I saw twice black vultures stroll up to a caracara and watched the caracara bend over and the black vulture then preen, use its bill to preen and scratch the back of the caracara's neck. And that just blew me away. It's that's a behavior that is known within certain species, where birds that are socially very close, like a mated pair or members of a family group, will preen each other in that way, and it's a social bonding thing. But to see these two birds that are completely unrelated, mm-hmm. in different families, engaged in this fairly intimate social behavior, it was just incredible. And I have no explanation for it. I've heard one other report of it. Someone else saw it 20 years earlier. But that has to be the most unexpected bird behavior I have ever seen.
Oh. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I wonder, somebody called about hummingbirds a minute ago, so I thought I would call and ask your guest about his presentation of hummingbirds in his guide to the birds. Mostly in guides, you just see them in a perch position, but he has presented them in different attitudes in flight, which gives a much better picture of the diagnostic characteristics. But I wondered if he's familiar with Gould's monograph of the Trochilidae and the Lynx Handbook of Birds of the World, and if he has presented these birds in ideal light, which shows, you know, the iridescent plumage to best advantage.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those other books, and I did something that I tried to do for every species in my field guide was to show them in flight and at rest and in a number of different poses and different plumages to show the whole range of appearances. I did try to show the hummingbirds in ideal lighting to show the true colors. One of the things about the hummingbirds that I've noticed in my experience is that the brilliant iridescent colors that you see on the throat and crown of most of the male hummingbirds is only really visible when the bird is facing you. So if you're looking at a hummingbird that you're seeing in profile, that you're looking at the side of its head, the throat and crown can look drab, dark gray or blackish. And then a split second later, as the bird turns its head and faces you, suddenly there's this glaring flash of iridescent neon purple or blue or red. And I tried to show that in my book by illustrating the birds in profile with their drab throat colors, the way they actually look in the field, and then the same species, the same plumage, facing you, showing the brilliance of that iridescent color.
I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. David, I want to thank you as well. David Allen Sibley, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. And thanks for the autographed book, which we'll give away to a listener this afternoon. It's been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. I'm sorry I've got to wrap it up at this point.
All right. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure here, too.
David Allen Sibley, our guest this afternoon. He is the author of The Sibley Guide to Birds, the author and illustrator. He is also the illustrator for The Sibley Guide to Bird Life and Behavior. He's the illustrator for that book. He also worked on the editorial content of that book as well. Both books are publications of the National Audubon Society, published for the Society by Knopf.